thanks for tuning in to the 10th and Broad Church of Christ podcast. This episode is presented by preaching minister Josh Yeager. Let's tune in now for Josh's message.
So we've been working through our core values for the past few months as a church. We've been on a journey since the beginning of this year. We had three corporate conversations as a church, where we just tried to discover who we are. We tried to list out, okay, what's been important to us over the years, and what has God instilled in us over the past few years, or over the past century. It's been over a century since 10th and Broad came into being here in Wichita Falls, and so we're just trying to build off of that stuff. And as we put all that together in our conversations, and as we just mulled over it as elders and as ministers, we realized that there's eight values that we feel that God has instilled in us. And so we've been working our way through those values, and we call those core values, because we feel like God has placed these into 10th and Broad in a way that we can build off of them and move into the future. And the first value we talked about was loving care. We talked about the idea that whether we're doing life or whether we're in crisis, we are committed to caring for those people in our midst. So we are committed to that as a church. That is a value of ours. Then we went on to wall-shattering evangelism, and we talked about how we will go over, around, or through the barriers that keep us from reaching our neighbors, our state, our country, and the world. And we realized that this is a weak point of ours, and so we're going to try to build this up. And so we set a goal over the next 2 years. We want to double our engagement with lost people in the world as a church, not just sending people across across oceans or north into Canada, but actually us engaging our neighbors. And so we set a goal of doubling in the next 2 years our engagement with non-Christians. And one of the ways that we're making that happen is we're offering a class on Wednesday nights that's about evangelism in a post-Christian culture. And it's not an easy class. There's expectations, and there's reading, and there's some things that you're going to have to do in that class, but it's part of this goal of trying to double our engagement with the lost. And then 2 weeks ago, we finished up worship together, and we talked about how we will proclaim in excellence and relevance the gospel message every single week. We feel that that is one of our core values, and so we focused in on that for about 4 weeks on worship together. Now, next month in January, we're going to move into spiritual growth, and we're going to talk about the value of spiritual growth, and we're actually going to set a goal for our church because we want to start the year off right. We want to set a goal, and we want to, as a church, read 60,000 Bible verses in the month of January. And you're like, how's that possible? Well, here's the thing. If 200 people read 10 verses a day for 30 days, that's 60,000, okay? So we're going to set a goal that we're going to try to read 60,000 verses as a church. Now, you can get your family around, on an evening, and you can read 10 verses together. Hey, that's 40 verses right there in one night, okay? So we as a church are going to try to read 60,000 verses, and we'll be explaining that. If that none of that makes sense to you, it's okay. We'll explain it more later, but just know that get geared up, because in January, we're going to start the year off right. We're going to just try to permeate ourselves with God's word and just build and grow and begin the year right. So that's coming up next month. But today, we are in the midst of celebration. We're in the midst of celebration. Justin kicked off our series last week, this idea of Advent. And, a lot of us that didn't grow up with that word, we get a little uncomfortable with that because, some other branches of Christianity use that word, and we don't necessarily agree with everything that they believe. But here's what Advent means, basically. Okay, there's a lot more depth and there's a lot more tradition to this, but basically this just means the arrival of a notable person. Okay, that's the idea of Advent. There's actually, you can actually have an Advent when somebody else notable shows up. But in church language, the Advent is when Jesus arrives on earth. And Justin spoke last week about this idea of Jesus coming in. And he spoke from Isaiah that this is the beginning of God's effort to bring us home. And we are a people who we have experienced exile. We have lived in the desert. But Jesus is a stream in the desert who is providing a path home for us as Christians. And so Justin talked a lot about that last week. If you missed that lesson, go to our website, tenthandbroad.org, or find us on iTunes. Listen to that because it all works together. Now, in our culture, Christmas can be a really great time of year, right? It can. I mean, we've already heard talked a little bit about that. It can be a great time of year because, you know, there's so much gift giving going on. There's a concern for the less fortunate. You know, people are at Christmas time. It's like everybody's going, you know, out of their way to give food away and to give presents away to people who don't have it and to do things. There's the lights everywhere. Right? Man, I love the lights. This town knows how to do lights well. I mean, I love driving around Wichita Falls. I feel like there have not been many places that I've lived that just does lights as well as Wichita Falls. There's the Christmas music that's being played over the radio and that maybe you're listening to. I was listening to Christmas music yesterday morning as I was cooking breakfast. I love Christmas music. There's the parades that happen during Christmas time. And then there's the cocoa and the carols. And I mean, you could just go on and on about what's so good about this time of year, but this time of year is also difficult for some people. I mean, you've been there. You've probably felt it. You've felt the loss when, you know, your family gathers and that person isn't there anymore, and you're missing them because it's Christmas time and family is supposed to be together. You know, sometimes people just feel a sense of loss, not because they've necessarily lost something, but because they've just never had something. You know, they've never had a big family to gather with, and, you know, maybe they didn't have kids for some reason, or you know, all their families moved away, or maybe they just weren't part of a big family. And so you kind of have this tendency at times. Christmas can also be a very depressing time for people who have either lost or just never had. Or maybe you're like me, and Christmas time is really a struggle because what do you want to do at Christmas time? You want to eat all the food, right? I mean, what do people give you? They give you cookies and they give you this, and you just like, and you're like, yeah. And then you hit January 1st and you're like, man, I better go on a diet January 1st because of everything that I've eaten during Christmas time. Or maybe you get through the Christmas holiday and, you know, you've just spent too much money, you know, because you bought presents for people who, you know, probably really, you know, they kind of wanted them, but they didn't really need them. But that's just what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to buy presents for everybody. You're supposed to buy them for your kids and for your, you know, your nieces and nephews and grandkids. And you hit January 1 and you're like, oh, why did I spend all that money on all those things? I really didn't have the money to do it. So we often end up on the other side of the Christmas holiday in one of two states. Either we have this sense of loss. Maybe, you know, I always get kind of sad when Christmas is over just because I mean, the lights are gone, they're put down, everything's just kind of dreary, you know, the trees are just normal again and everything's just kind of sad. Or maybe it's that your family has gone back and everybody's going back to business as usual and there's just this lack of concern again for people. Or perhaps it's just a sense of relief, you know. Man, I'm glad it's over, you know. It's just painful being around that person, you know, that has those opposing political views that they're going to bring up, and I just don't even know what I'm going to say to them, that family member. So here's what I hope happens in this series. My hope is that we come out on the other side with a bit of reorienting as a disciple of Jesus, as a follower of Jesus, and try to focus on, even though I know that this wasn't Jesus' birthday, let's focus on the reality of God coming to earth and Jesus coming to this place where you just can't explain why he would come to this place sometime. Why would God come in fully human form? I mean, that's something that I believe that it can reorient us and it can focus us. And instead of coming out on the other side of Christmas kind of depressed or worn out or beat down, we can come out reoriented and ready to celebrate. So one of our core values is celebration. One of our core values as a church, we at 10th and Broad like to celebrate. You know, that's what tonight is all about. We're going to have some fun tonight. I mean, we're going to enjoy some good food. We're going to enjoy some good music and entertainment. We're going to have a great time. And the way we state it is that we will recognize and rejoice in what God is up to and what God has done in the world. That's what celebration is about. We're going to recognize and rejoice in what God is up to and what he has done in the world. So tonight we're going to be celebrating a little bit. And we're going to allow the Matthew story to guide our thoughts as we grow in our celebration of who Jesus is and what he has done in this world. Now, Matthew begins his story in kind of this oddball way. You know, if you've ever just started reading the Gospel of Matthew, he just begins it weird because if you know anything about writing, and I've never published anything. I mean, I've had several people tell me that I should publish at least my poetry, and I've written lots of stories. I'm kind of a story writer, and you know, maybe someday I'll get around to publishing. But if you know anything about writing, if you know anything about a story, you know that you want to grab your audience in those first paragraphs, like literally within the first few sentences. You better have grabbed onto that person, right? Because there's, for one thing, in our culture, there is so much literature out there. You know, people will give you a chapter, maybe. They might just give you four paragraphs. They might give you one page. And if they're not grabbed by what they read, they're going to find something else. And so you know you've got to grab something. Well, Matthew does this weird thing. He starts his story about Jesus with a genealogy. Okay, and so here's what happens for us oftentimes. We read the first few words of Matthew's gospel. This is the genealogy, and we're like, pause, skip that. And then we move on to the more exciting part in verse 19, right? How many people have done that? Just admit it, okay? You've done it. Maybe you haven't. Maybe you can polish your halo a little bit if you haven't done that. But I've done it. Okay, so we hit that genealogy and we think, oh man, okay, I don't have time for that. I'll move on to something else. But many of us, we just don't know what to do with a genealogy in Scripture. So my goal as we read this is to help us to read this genealogy through the first century eyes. In other words, read it the way that those ancient Christians would have read it. Because here's the thing. Matthew did intend for his audience to just be grabbed by this seemingly arbitrary relaying of names. He wanted them to read it and anticipate and eat the words and to grab something by his saying of these names. So this morning, I just want to help us to do that, to read it as that first century culture would have read it. So Matthew chapter 1, verse 1. This is a genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Now, if you know anything about ancient literature, you also know that it was always read out loud. It was never meant to be read silently and passively as we read literature. You know, when we read literature, we read it and we just become passive. We look for the literature to do everything. But ancient literature meant for the readers to participate and to enter the story, because the reality for most people is that most people couldn't read, and there were only a few people who could read. So the person would get up to read, and he would read it, and he would read it well, and he would read it with feeling and purpose, and there would be pauses and stops to just let the story just kind of ruminate with the people. And so I bet the leader of the church would read, this is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham, and all of a sudden, they would be drawn into this story, because Jesus is the Messiah. And if you know anything about that word, Messiah, you know, oops, what just happened? Okay, there we go. My page just got out of order just a second. Okay, you know that word Messiah, it's a word that's prophesied. It's prophesied by Jeremiah and Ezekiel. He's going to be the ideal king. And you know that there have been moments when genealogies have been brought forth in Scripture, like in Ruth. in the book of Ruth, when you find out the background of King David, and that it was actually a Moabite woman who was basically responsible for the greatest king ever in Israelite history coming to live. You know that there was a genealogy in 1 Chronicles chapters 2 through 4 where we see the progression of God's people and the way he worked through them and how he acted and how he revealed himself to them. And so, and you also read that word son of David and you think, yes, he's coming from the right stock. He is royalty. And then you see that word, son of Abraham, and you think, oh, wow, the pioneer of faith, the one that God called, the heir of the promise. And you remember back to the promise that God made to Abraham that they would be a great nation and that all nations would be blessed through his seed, through his people, through the people that would come from him. And you would remember all that and you would ruminate and you think, yes, this is who we're talking about. This is who I follow. And then he would go on to Abraham was the father of Isaac. And you remember Isaac. Oh yes, Isaac was the son of promise. He was the one that Abraham and Sarah waited for years and years for. And finally, he showed up on the scene, but then he wasn't getting married. And God actually orchestrated that whole thing too. You know, the servant that Abraham called said, hey, go find a wife for my son Isaac. And the servant made a deal with God and God came through and he brought his new wife. And you think Isaac, the father of Jacob. Oh yeah, I remember Jacob. Do you remember Jacob? Jacob was the trickster. He was the one who stole the birthright from his brother Esau. He was the one who stole the blessing from his brother Esau. And God changed this trickster into the nation of Israel. He renamed Jacob Israel and he went from being a trickster to the one who wrestles with God, Israel. And Jacob, the father of Judah. Oh, do you remember Judah? Yeah, I remember Judah. Judah was the one who, you know, really hated his brother Joseph. And he was the one who was behind, you know, kind of the instigator of putting him in the pit. He wanted to kill him, but he got talked out of that. And Judah just continued to hate his brother. But then he had this turnaround in his life. When he basically took over the leadership of the family, Reuben wasn't stepping up. And so Judah, he stepped up and he became the father of kings. And Judah and his brother, and Judah, the father of Perez, and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar, and all of a sudden, the audience goes, what are you, Tamar? What are you talking about, Tamar? Matthew, I'm raise my hand, and I'm going to say, hey, church leader, I think you read that wrong. I don't think Tamar is in there. Tamar's not supposed to be in there. Women don't belong in genealogies, and this is what Matthew wrote. She's there. And you're like, well, I remember Tamar. That was a hard story. That was a difficult story. I remember what happened because, you know, Judah gave his first son to Tamar and they got married. Well, then that first son died. So Judah gave his second son. Well, that second son died too. And Judah had a third son, but he wasn't giving that third son to Tamar. No way. Because, you know, this girl was bad luck or something. And so she played the role of a prostitute. As Judah was walking along a road and Judah went and took the prostitute, had relations with her, and that's how the line continued. And you're like, why are you including Tamar in the storyline? And the reader says, just calm down. Let's keep reading. Maybe it'll come clear as we keep reading. So Tamar, Perez, the father of Hezron, Hezron, the father of Ram, and Ram, the father of Amminadab, and Amminadab, the father of Nashon, and Nashon, the father of Salmon. And we're like, man, who are these people? We don't recognize these people. Why did Matthew put these people in here? And once again, the readers probably say, just be patient. Let's get to the end. Let's see what Matthew has for us. And Salmon, the father of Boaz. Oh, I remember Boaz. I remember the story of Boaz and the way that he was the kinsman redeemer and how he lived out just the ideals of Israel. He left, you know, he left grain in his field so that people, so that poor people could come along and pick up the grains. You know, they didn't have government issued food back in those days. It was actually the responsibility of every farmer, and Boaz actually lived that out. He lived out leaving grain in the fields. And Boaz, whose mother was Rahab, and you're like, ah, Matthew, what are you doing? I mean, first you include Tamar, and then you include Rahab. What are you doing? Because, I mean, not only did you include Tamar, who played the part of a prostitute, well, she wasn't actually a prostitute, she just played the part, but then you include Rahab, who was a prostitute. I mean, she was the one in the promised land who hid the spies, and she was running a brothel house. I mean, she was not a good person. I mean, yeah, she did become a believer, but I mean, the beginnings, it was horrible, and she's not even an Israelite. What are you doing, Matthew? But the reader just goes on, and he goes on. He says, and Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. And once again, he's just like, okay, Matthew, this is getting a little bit too much. Okay, you're not supposed to be mentioning women in genealogies. But not only are you mentioning women, but you're also mentioning the wrong women. I mean, why are you mentioning these women who are not, you know, upstanding women? They're not, and not only are they not upstanding, the majority of them are not Jews. I mean, Ruth was a Moabite, the hated enemy of God's people. I think the reader would just say, let's keep reading. And then Obed, the father of Jesse. And oh yes, I remember Jesse. Remember that story? That was a great story. You know, Jesse, Samuel shows up at his door. And he shows up and he says, I'm here to anoint the next king of Israel. And, so he parades his best sons. I mean, the good-looking, strong, strapping young men ready to be king. And Samuel says, nope, none of them. None of them. You got any more? And he's like, well, we got the boy out, you know, the youngest out taking care of the sheep, but you're not going to want him. Let me see him, Samuel says. So Jesse, the father of King David, the greatest ruler, the one who it was promised that David would have a son on the throne forever. David was the father of Solomon. Solomon, the greatest king, the one in whose, under his reign, it was the golden reign of Israel. It was under his reign that Israel came closest to being a blessing to all nations, because people came from all around to hear of Solomon's wisdom. But Solomon fell. He fell. Solomon, whose mother had been Uriah's wife. And once again, you're like, okay, Matthew, why are you bringing Bathsheba up in this? You know, the worst part of David's life, you know, the biggest mistake, the big boo-boo, it wasn't a boo-boo, it was a big, huge, fat sin. He did it on purpose. Why are you bringing Bathsheba up in this? Then we go on. Solomon, the father of Rehoboam. And, oh yeah, I remember Rehoboam. That was a sad moment in Israel history when he decided to tax the daylights out of the Israelite people. And all the tribes except for Judah ran away. And North Israel split from South Judah. Saddest moment in Israelite history. Now I remember Rehoboam, the father of Abijah. And Abijah was an evil and idolatrous king. And we were ashamed of him. And then I remember Abijah, the father of Asa. And Asa, he actually turned things around, the religious reforms. And then his son, Jehoshaphat, verse 8, would come along. And Jehoshaphat would continue the reforms of his father. And he would have great success, great military success. And he would extend the borders of South Judah. And the Jehoshaphat, the father of Jehoram. And Jehoram, oh, he was a disappointment. He turned from God. Jehoram, the father of Uzziah, he was a good king, but wait a second, Matthew, I think you missed some kings along the way. Jehoram was not the father of Uzziah. He was actually his great-great-grandfather, because I think there was, you know, Ahaziah and Joash and Amaziah between Jehoram and Uzziah, and you're like, and So immediately the people would be thinking, what's going on here? Why did he skip three kings? Why did he skip three generations? And I think the reader would once again say, let's wait till the end. Let's wait till the end and see if Matthew has something for us. So Uzziah, he was a great king. Once again, great military success. Uzziah, the father of Jotham, and he was a decent king. He was okay. Jotham, the father of Ahaz, once again, an evil king. Turned from God, turned the people from God. But then a bright light, Hezekiah, came along and he reformed all the people and he called the people back to God. But then another downturn, Manasseh, the most evil king of Judah, most evil king, sacrificed his own children to be sacrificed to the evil gods. But then Manasseh would have Josiah, another great reformer, but the reform didn't get to finish because Josiah would end up getting killed in battle. And then Jeconiah, or also known as Jehoahaz, and he was renamed, he was exiled. And the people of Judah were gone from the earth. They did not have a nation anymore. But then Shealtiel would come along. And we don't really know much about him, but he had a great son named Padiah. And once again, Matthew skips Padiah and goes straight to Zerubbabel. And Zerubbabel was a great man. He led the rebuilding of the temple. He did lots of great things, and the people of Israel were starting to come back. But we know that it didn't take. The people of Israel just, they kept falling away and they kept breaking covenant and they could not remain faithful. And then Zerubbabel has, there's a line after Zerubbabel that we just don't know anything about. Maybe they had some knowledge of these people. Maybe they had some records. But Zerubbabel had a son named Abiud, and then Eliakim, and then Azor, and Zadok, and Akim, and Eliad, and Eleazar, and Mathan. And Mathan was the father of Jacob. And then verse 16, and Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary. And Mary was the mother of Jesus, who is called the Messiah. Now listen to this. Thus, there were 14 generations in all, from Abraham to David, 14 from David to exile to Babylon, and 14 from the exile to the Messiah. And we're like, Matthew, you skipped a few in there. You kind of forced something in there. And here's the thing. A lot of times people say, well, this is a mistake that Matthew made. No, Matthew had access to the same scriptures we have. Matthew did this on purpose. He did it on purpose to make a point, a theological point. You know, a lot of times we like to get stuck in the, you know, and think that the numbers are, you know, important. Well, they are important, but oftentimes in different ways than a modern audience thinks. And so that leads us to the first of our takeaways. And let me just point this out. The first of our takeaways from this seemingly boring section of Scripture is that the sun does not revolve around you. And you're like, how did you get that, Josh? The sun does not revolve around you. Let me see if I can explain this. So as we look at Matthew's explanation, there are 14 generations, three sets of 14. You see that? Three sets of 14. Now, I've heard all kinds of explanations about what this means, okay? I've heard that the Hebrew word, the Hebrew letters, there's actually no vowels in Hebrew. So the word David would be D-V-D in Hebrew. Now, loosely, okay? I'm not a Hebrew scholar, but it would be D-V-D. And the interesting thing, now, I know it's kind of funny, right? DVD. But the thing about it is that in Hebrew, the letters actually doubled for numbers. Okay, so D was a double for four, the number four. V was a double for six, and then the D again, number four. So four plus six plus four is 14. And basically, the idea is that so here we have this. Number, these three sets of 14, and God, three is God's number, okay? Three is God's number, and so we have everything that God has been doing pointing down to this one moment in history. I've also heard it explained this way. There are three generations of 14. In other words, if you know anything about math, you know 7 plus 7 is 14, right? Okay, so you got 7 plus 7 plus 7 plus, so six sevens, and Jesus is the beginning of the seventh seven. Does that make sense? Is that totally, how many people that went, did that go over your head? Raise your hand if that just went over your head. Okay, nobody's going to admit it. Okay, well, here's the point. Regardless of how you explain it, Matthew is pointing that everything has been counting down to this point right here in history. The reason he uses those numbers, the reason he makes it so uniform is he says God has been at work. Everything has been counting down to this point right here when Jesus arrives on the earth. And the reason that that's so important for us to understand as Western Christians is that we believe that everything is about us. You have been told your entire life that everything is about you and what you want to do and what you want to do with your life, what you're going to eat, what job you're going to do, what activity you're going to do, what marriage partner you're going to have, what beliefs you're going to have. You've been told your entire life that everything revolves around you. And Matthew says that's not true. Everything revolves around Jesus. Everything in this world, everything in creation, everything that God has been doing through people revolves around Jesus. And some of you this morning need to hear this because you believe that your schedule, your work, your money, your retirement is all more important than what Jesus has called you to. And what Matthew is calling his audience to understand is that Jesus is the most important thing, is the most important person, and everything in creation has been pointing to this one moment about Jesus. And so these people, as they are trying to navigate this new following of Jesus, as they are trying to navigate the fact that they have Gentile people in their culture, they're also trying to navigate the fact that many of them grew up with the law and the Old Testament, and they're trying to figure out how do I live out all these different things, and Matthew is calling them back to center and saying, it's all about Christ. You need to realize that everything is about you and is about Christ, and it's not all about you. Because that's what humans tend to do. We tend to believe that I'm more important. And even though we say, oh no, Jesus is more important, or the church is more important, our actions speak otherwise. And we show by our actions that Jesus is not the center and that instead we are. Number two, and this comes from the first one, Jesus is the epitome of all that is Israel. You see, Jesus is literally, he is the culmination of everything that is Israel. He is the greatest part of the Abrahamic covenant. In other words, the blessing to all nations has been fulfilled in Jesus. He is alive and he is promised to be on the throne. And we no longer have to look for a Messiah because he is here and he comes from royal stock. And there is no doubt that he is the heir that we have been looking for. And number three builds right off of that. Jesus is also the epitome of the rest of the world. You see, what's so amazing about Matthew is he does not sweep the less than stellar elements under the rug, right? He doesn't sweep Rahab under the rug. He doesn't sweep Tamar under the rug. He doesn't sweep Bathsheba or Manasseh or anybody. He doesn't sweep any of those people away. In fact, he owns them and he says, you know, everybody is welcome into this community created by Christ. Everybody is welcome into this community. Now, we have to wrap our minds around that because we come up with reasons why people don't belong, and sometimes it's not even that we're coming up with a reason. It's just that when we start to interact with that person, they see the world differently, or they don't have their life together. We just have a tendency to just kind of push them aside. And I know we don't mean to. I know we don't have the intention of pushing them aside. It just kind of happens because we like to congregate with people that think like us and talk like us and have a heart and a desire like us. But Matthew is reminding us that everything is welcome into this community. Because Jesus came from everything. He came from Gentiles. He came from Jews. He came from evil. He came from good. Everybody is welcome into this community. And he is real. Jesus is real. I read a story that was just fascinating of this missionary. She was actually with the Wycliffe Bible Translation Committee. And she went into this kind of remote place in Papua New Guinea to learn the language of an indigenous people and create an alphabet because they didn't have a written language. So she goes in there, she learns the language, she creates the alphabet, teaches them how to read. And then her goal was after that, it took 10 years to accomplish that, by the way. And then after that, she was going to begin translating scripture into their language. So the first book she decided to translate was the book of Matthew. And of course, the genealogy was difficult because it had all those weird names. And, you know, so she actually decided to skip the genealogy. She decided to skip the genealogy. And so she got this whole gospel translated, and she you know, ordered it from the Bible translation group, and they sent it on these big trucks, and they came into the village, and she was so proud of this book that she had, you know, that she had taken part in making it happen. And, you know, she handed it to the people, and they were like, "Oh, interesting." But you know what they were really interested in? The trucks. They just were walking around the trucks, and they were looking at them like, "Wow, look at these things. We've never seen anything like this before." And they almost disregarded this gospel, this project that she'd been working on for 10 years. Well, she continued to stay among the people and continued to work and continued to tell stories of Jesus. And so she decided to come up with a second edition of Matthew, and she decided to go ahead and include the genealogy this time. And as she included the genealogy, and once again, the trucks came in with the books, and she handed the book to the chief, and the chief started reading, and he read the first 18 verses, he read the first 18 verses, and he read the first 18 verses, and he looked at her, and he said, "You mean this person that you've been telling us about is a real person? He's a real person? He came from people?" And that moment, those first 18 verses led to the conversion of nearly the entire tribe because they realized that Jesus was a real person. And if there's anything that you get from this genealogy, it's that God has been at work in the midst of humanity, and he didn't just pop Jesus into existence. He was part of a people, and he used a people to bring Jesus into being and to bring him into this place that we see as the world. He is the epitome of all that is Israel. He is the epitome of the rest of the world, and Jesus is the center. This is what the genealogy is calling us to see. Jesus is the center, and he came from real people. I would just encourage you this morning to just consider, what implications does this have for you? Have you made Jesus the center? What has taken his place? Is there something else that has been in the focus? Maybe you've been focused on, you know, keeping all the rules. Because that's what the Jews, that's what Matthew's community was really struggling with. They were struggling with, well, what do we do with all the rules in the Old Testament? And Matthew would say, focus on Jesus. Focus on Christ. Maybe you've been focused on things that are good, but maybe you haven't been focused on Christ. And I think we are all called to reorient our lives so that everything centers on Christ. Let's continue in worship this morning.